there. Thanks for joining us for today's podcast. This is Pengfei Zhao, one of your hosts for the New Books in Education. Today, I will be talking with Jessica Lester, Chad Lochmiller, and Rachel Gabriel on their edited volume, Discursive Perspectives on Education Policy and Implementation. The book was published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2017. It won this year's AERA Qualitative Research SIG Outstanding Book Award. Among the many things that you will hear about this award-winning book, I will just highlight a few here. What are discursive perspectives? How will these perspectives help us think of education policies differently? And how did the editors organize a seamless collaboration to produce an award-winning book? One of the exciting things about the book, and I will put it right here, is it delineates a new orientation for the study of education policies. With that, I will leave you to the interview. And again, thanks for being with us. I hope you enjoy. I'm here to talk with Jessica Lester, Chad Lochmiller, and Rachel Gabriel about their new book, Discursive Perspectives on Educational Policy and Implementation. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So let's start with a brief self-introduction. Maybe you can take turns to introduce yourself to our audience. So I wonder which order we should take. Maybe Jessica, you should go first.
Sure. Thanks, Pengfei. So I'm Jessica Lester. I'm an associate professor at Indiana University in the Inquiry Methodology Program. And my areas of focus have centered around discourse studies, and quite often a lot of my substantive work is also in the area of critical disability studies in educational contexts as well as mental health contexts.
And I'm Chad Lochmiller. I'm an assistant professor in educational leadership and policy studies at Indiana University, and my research interests include issues both related to education policy and educational leadership, specifically those involving resource allocation and human resource development.
And Rachel?
I'm Rachel Gabriel. I'm an associate professor of literacy education at the University of Connecticut. I teach in a program that prepares reading specialists to work in K-12 schools, and my research focuses on teacher development and evaluation and the policies that interact with literacy learning opportunities.
Well, thank you all. And it sounds like you have very different expertise. And this is a book of a collaboration. So how did you come up with this collaborative idea? And even how did you get to know each other?
Yeah, this is Jessica. I'm happy to frame a little bit first about how we came to this book project. So initially, it was in May of 2014. We were all attending the International Congress of Qualitative Inquiry, which is an annual international gathering at University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois. And we were literally just having a conversation in between sessions about the ways in which discursive perspectives may inform policy research, and recognizing that we all come from slightly different backgrounds. It was a conversation wherein we shared our different perspectives. So we were really interested in the ways that language-based methods might be used to study education policy. So I came at it from a methodological perspective, of course. And Rachel and Chad both offered really different and unique policy perspectives as well. And so initially, we started this project by pursuing special issue with Educational Policy Analysis Archives Journal. And specifically, this was an open call where we invited people to propose both methodological and empirical pieces that discussed and or empirically illustrated the ways in which discursive perspectives might be leveraged to make sense of education policy issues. So the open call, perhaps I think for all of us, we were really surprised. I know the editors of the journal were surprised as well. We had a really tremendous response, far more submissions of interest than we could ever even imagine including in a special issue. So there was great interest in this topic. And it led to a two-part special issue that were published in 2016 and 2017 in the Education Policy Analysis Archives. And one of the special issues focused on critical discourse analysis and education policy, something that has had a long-standing position in ed policy. And the other issue in 2017 focused on really diverse perspectives of language-based methodologies for making sense of education policy issues writ large. So that was really how we came to this project. And then after that, we realized there was more to say. And we tapped our special issue authors and invited them to consider continuing the conversation in the form of an edited volume.
And it's important to understand that the case study perspective has really been the dominant methodological approach in terms of studying policy implementation and conducting most policy analyses. And so when we looked at the literature and we looked at various published studies, particularly those from the UK by Stephen Ball, we saw that discourse perspectives were increasingly valued, but they hadn't necessarily permeated the United States policy context. And so we chose to create this volume really in response to that gap and recognize that the opportunities to contribute to that discussion were something that we felt could push the field to understand policy implementation at a much more micro level, as opposed to some of the big macro understandings that we currently had.
Well, thank you. So do you have anything to add, Rachel?
No, I think I'm struck by kind of how coherent the whole stream comes together, because I think when all of these things were surprises to us, as Jessica sort of mentioned. So what started as a small conversation just between three researchers who knew each other and who knew each other's work really blossomed into a whole coherent train that other scholars were able to jump on. And as we learned from them, we were able to create not one, but two issues of the journal that Jessica mentioned, and then also move the conversation forward towards a conversation that engaged the field as a whole, instead of only kind of collecting examples of what could be possible. And so I think that's what's been exciting about this collaboration, is that we've been able to talk with each other and talk with colleagues about what has been happening in the field of policy studies, what could be happening, and to really sustain that level of conversation, which, as Chad said, kind of reaches beyond this individual policy, individual case mentality that I think a lot of us were trained and submerged in for a long time. So I paused because as I was listening, I thought, wow, that all fits together. But if you live through it, it doesn't always feel as a coherent.
Yeah, it's exciting. And now I can't wait to move us to a conversation about the book itself. And I wonder if any one of you could, I have like several points I really would like to talk with you. But first of all, I wonder if any one of you could give us an overview of the book itself. And then I feel like there are just several points emerging from the conversation we can dive deeper into, like the distinction between the macro level and the micro level studies of education policies, and also how this perspective may move, may direct the studies of education policy to a different direction. So yeah, let's start with an overview first. And any one of you would like to talk more about that?
I'm happy to offer an overview, and then we'll invite my colleagues to jump in and fill in the blanks as well.
So sure,
the edited volume is a 12-chapter text, and four of the chapters provide in various ways an offering of the landscape, either of educational policy or a methodological landscape. And then the eight remaining chapters, which are contributed from colleagues with varying levels of expertise in connection to educational policy and or language-based methodologies. The remaining eight chapters are empirical examples a variety of ways that you can make sense of language-based perspectives, such as membership categorization or particular approaches to critical discourse analysis. We also have a post-qualitative orientation to discourse analysis specific to policy, et cetera, et cetera. So those eight chapters are offerings that illustrate how particular language-based methodologies can really push the bounds of how we make sense of policy in varying ways. And then the other chapters, as I mentioned, provide some methodological and or substantive understandings. So our second chapter is one that attends to the literature connected to policy implementation and offers an understanding of the various methodological approaches that have been taken up to understand policy implementation as a way to really call for more language-based perspectives. Our third chapter is one that offers a landscape of language-based methodologies and is really pedagogical in scope as well, so that those that are perhaps new to language-based methodologies but not new to education policy could use that chapter to make sense of how they might further study a particular perspective and or take it up in the future. And then our final chapter is one that sets the stage for future understandings and future potential directions for how education policy might bump up against and engage with language-based perspectives.
And I think one of the other important things that this book does is it actually critiques many of the existing approaches that have been used in education policy research. And it does so in a way that really invites the reader to pause and think critically about how the field has attended to issues of policy implementation, and more importantly, how the field has actually been bound by some of those approaches and thus missed some of the opportunities to understand how individual policy actors make sense of and respond to policy mandates, policy directives. And the most important thing that it does as well is it invites more deeper and more thoughtful consideration of some of the implicit issues in policy discourses. So the book really takes on some of the staid notions of what policy research should be, and it tries to advance those notions using a language-based approaches. And Rachel, do you have anything to add?
No, I think that's a super clear summary. Thanks, guys.
So Chad, I wonder if you could say a little bit more about these critiques. You know, I have to keep in mind that our podcast is for a more general audience, so they may not have the knowledge about the current state of the field of education policy studies. So first of all, would you like to say a little bit more about those previous educational policy studies? I mean, the approaches and basically like what this book has been criticizing for about,
well, of the original policy research approaches were based on the rational actor model, which was essentially that legislators or policymakers devised a policy and then communicated the intent of that policy to localized policy actors who carried it out in somewhat of a hierarchical or a supervisor-subordinate relationship. What we've seen, though, through particularly more recent policy research is that it's become increasingly clear that local policy actors actually engage in what has been referred to as street-level bureaucracy. So Weatherly and Lipsky's notion of street-level bureaucracy suggests that individual policy actors actually make sense of the policy mandates that are communicated to them within localized and specific policy contexts. And one of the things that most of the policy literature has done since the 1970s, when that perspective came out, is really tried to put its hands around what that process looked like or how it unfolded. And so some of Jim Spillane's more recent work, for example, has really sought to introduce this notion of cognitive perspectives being tied to the policy implementation process. So how do individuals think about and make sense of policy before they actually proceed to the process of implementing it? And one of the things that this book really tries to do is to say that if we're thinking about policy implementation as a cognitive activity, then we also need to be thinking about policy implementation as a language-based activity. So how does the discourse serve as the best and most logical reflection of an individual's cognitive understanding of the policy? that's something that has not really been studied widely or deeply in the policy literature. And so that's one of the things that we really wanted to attend to. The other thing is that policy scholars have become increasingly focused on issues of power and inequity within policy research. And one of the most common ways or the most practical ways that policy scholars can actually carry out or make sense of those issues is that they look at the discourse of how policy issues are being framed within the public space or within meeting spaces or within individual exchanges between legislators on the state house floor. And so all of those create new opportunities, particularly when language-based methods are brought to bear, to begin unpacking how those understandings and substantive perspectives can be applied, and most importantly, how those issues can be unpacked in a way that help us understand why policies work and don't work in ways that we previously haven't considered. So it's really a critique on many levels, and then it's also to a certain extent extensions or kind of a synthesis of the research that has already been published. And it's important to really connect all of those bodies of literature, because one of the things that's happened, I think, in a lot of the more contemporary policy literature is that scholars are applying new and varied perspective to understanding policy issues, but they may not necessarily be embedding those understandings within some of the existing perspectives or norms of the field. And that's something that we were very careful to avoid doing in this book. We really tried to situate this book within some of those existing norms and use language-based methods as an exemplar or an example for bringing them together and making sense of them in some new and enlightened ways.
Well, that really explains very well how this new approach, our new perspective, differs from some of the previous studies. So can you give us some examples? I feel like an example probably will really helps understanding all of the points you brought out just now.
Rachel, can you speak to the study that you included in the volume?
The study that I did with Sarah Wolfen, who's an associate professor in educational leadership at the University of Connecticut, was a study of the testimony that people submitted in support or in argument against a bill that was before the Connecticut State Legislature. And this was of particular interest to me because the bill was related to reading remediation and instruction in public schools. But I'm also interested in it just from a methodological standpoint, because there is an increasing sort of body of work focused on the policy making process instead of only what happens once a policy is made and studying kind of the implementation afterwards, which is a focus for a lot of the authors in our book and something that I think Chad really described beautifully a moment ago. But we are interested in sort of how policy comes to be in the first place and how a microanalysis of the texts that are used or considered during policy construction and the conversations and the debates that ensue related to those texts inform what kinds of policies are made and also the context in which those policies are understood. So we draw on framing theory and ideas about how language is used to kind of create the context and repertoires of understanding that people bring to different issues. And the study that we looked at focuses on a bill that relates to dyslexia in particular, but we contrasted it with bills that exist in Connecticut already, and there are similar laws in lots of other states that had really similar foci in terms of what the law mandates that schools do, but the framing was different. So instead of framing these laws that control reading assessment and instruction as laws that were meant to support greater social equity or meant to support literacy for secondary educational outcomes or literacy for college and career readiness, this bill had a lot of the same legal mechanisms in it of existing legislation. And really the only difference was that the frame was that these things are now being done not just to promote educational equity or educational outcomes in general, but specifically equity and outcomes for children with dyslexia labels. So we were interested in thinking through what that distinction meant and also in trying to understand how input from parents or input from the public in a broader sense influences the ways that policies are considered and the ways that policies are eventually written. So it probably would also be good to hear an example from the other side of the policymaking process, that implementation piece. But the article that Chad referred to is really focused on how policies are made in the first place.
And there are examples in the book of the implementation of discipline policy, the implementation of social welfare policy, and other policies that are that the analyst or that the researcher is actually focused on at the implementation level. But since Rachel was able to speak more knowledgeably to the study that she contributed, it makes sense to really highlight that as an exemplar. The other thing that I would say is that Rachel's approach is an approach that really mirrors and kind of symbolizes the approach that we're really encouraging scholars to take. And so it really doesn't matter which aspect of the policymaking or policy implementation process you're focused on. What really matters most is that you're using this kind of core approach or this core epistemological frame to understand the policy process itself.
So maybe if I understand you correctly, this approach really allows us to see the entire process very differently, from the making of the policy to the implementation of the policy.
I would say Pengfei, yes, but mm-hmm. It's really these approaches, not just this specific approach. We're not advocating one specific application of language-based methods. What we're arguing is that language-based methods in their entirety allow you to unpack and dissect and go more critically into various aspects of the entire policymaking process, from policy conceptualization all the way to policy implementation and evaluation.
Well, yes, thanks for the correction. And this leads smoothly and perfectly to my next question, which is, what are these perspectives and how shall we make sense of this entirety? So maybe I should direct this question to Jessica. And I wonder if Jessica could say a little bit more about how you conceptualize the discursive perspectives. Like, for example, how is it different from discourse analysis? As we know, like, discourse analysis itself is a pretty comprehensive approach and includes all different kind of perspectives.
Yeah. So first off, I would say it's we're not arguing for something different than the broad umbrella term of discourse analysis. So when we say language-based methodologies, we're just being encompassing in that mm-hmm. term. To assure that we include perspectives that some people in the literature, the methodological literature, don't always put underneath the umbrella of discourse analysis, such as conversation analysis. We have, for instance, a chapter around membership categorization analysis, which is an offshoot of conversation analysis. And that perspective is not always, sometimes it is, but it's not always included within the umbrella of discourse analysis. So language-based methods or methodologies is a term that is one that we're intentionally using to simply be more encompassing. We're not the only scholars that have used it either, we should note. There are others that use that terminology. But in this kind of the most straightforward way to think about these perspectives, discursive perspectives, there's lots of different ways that we could name them. But one of the ways that's really helpful to think about it is I like just envisioning an umbrella. And within this umbrella, there are lots of different approaches that have some uniquenesses. They're distinct from each other, yet they have some shared assumptions. And these perspectives generally focus on the ways in which language defined broadly, so including conversations, as well as text-based perspectives. Some scholars also attend to the visual. Some scholars also draw upon researcher-generated data like interviews and focus group data. There's a variety of types of data that would be included in these perspectives. But broadly, these perspectives are ones that attend to the way in which the language produces or performs something. So for instance, we know that through language, be it text or everyday conversations, that people go about doing things like invitations or blaming or positioning particular identities as more valid than another identity. So the assumption with these perspectives is that through this, the close study of language, we're able to understand the social world. We're able to understand how the world is organized. We're able to also understand how the ways in which the orderliness of the world might also be questioned or challenged. So in other words, these perspectives provide us with both the theoretical understanding as well as the methods-based tools to unpack how language is being used to do certain things, to carry out the business of the everyday life, of the institutional life of people.
So if I understand you correctly, you are really trying to emphasize the doing aspect of language use. Is that correct?
Yeah, so that is pretty common in language-based perspectives. It's not really unique to my perspective or to our perspective. That's one of the core assumptions of, we could say, language-based methodologies, and more specifically discourse analytic perspectives, that we're trying to make sense of the performative aspects of language, the doing of language. And this really gets to the underlying theories that undergird these perspectives and allow us to understand how life is performed through the enactment of language.
Yeah. So, as you said just now, people have been using all different kinds of data to study policies. So what kind of data? Like you mentioned texts and maybe also interview transcripts. What are some other forms?
Yeah, so just thinking about our edited volume as well as the special issues that are closely related to this edited volume, the kinds of data that the scholars have used and the three of us have used in our own work as well have really ranged from researcher-generated data such as interviews or focus groups, but also a lot of the contributors to our volume as well as special issue, perhaps unsurprisingly, also had a focus on policy documents. We also had a scholar that was focused on Twitter feeds. So the social media space itself was his primary data set. We also had some scholars that were attending to everyday interactions, so everyday conversations. I know that Rachel can speak to this more specifically, but Rachel is a really great example. Her scholarship is a great example of someone who's in the past actually analyzed policymakers having conversations. Rachel, do you want to speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I think this kind of connects with Chad's conversation earlier about this focus on language and language use, whether it be text or talk or a combination of the two, being almost a natural kind of next step or evolution of the focus on policy from something that was pretty static and stable, like this is the policy, people carry it out or don't, and we kind of policy analysis often just looked at the outcome of a policy, so what changed as a result, so after a policy was made, and then another way of really thinking about how the policy influenced changes in behavior that led to particular outcomes. My next step was to think about the sort of action orientation of language in making that policy in the first place, communicating that policy. So how do those understandings get shaped? And then how do responses to policy sort of get become enacted in different ways, often through text or talk themselves. So I've looked at the policymaking conversations of committees that are tasked with creating the text of the policy. So instead of seeing the text as a static, like non-negotiable statement of what the law is, I was interested in how those words were chosen and how those ideas were organized and what went on kind of behind the scenes or between the lines of what eventually is written into state law. To understand how different ideas get braided together, how different positions are held up or minimized or shut down, and when and where different perspectives come in. So I have looked at that with live data, just audio recording and transcripts of committees making decisions about how to write the actual policies, but also with text as well. So looking at newspaper articles that surrounded a policymaking moment, either right before a policy is constructed or just after, or a combination of the two. And so that sort of interest in how the media produces language around and about different policies that informs how people understand them and how they respond to them potentially is picked up with the idea of looking at something like social media representations of district policies or how superintendents talk about their district policies, which was one of the chapters in our book. So I think that answers the question. But I guess the connection there for me is that we no longer think of policy as this sort of static, monolithic thing that doesn't change and isn't dynamic. And we also are not only interested in people's responses to or understandings of policy, so not just how do they make sense of the policy as it's written, but really understanding all of those processes as first mediated by language, or they happen in and through language, whether that's talk between people or it's text that people have created and shared back and forth, or co-constructed and then shared back and forth. But also that the sort of understandings and meanings and outcomes of policy aren't limited to the who we consider policy actors and policy statements, not just like written down accounts or the laws themselves, but people who are sort of talking around and about it. So there are chapters in our book that also use the communication, talk or text, of special interest groups and advocacy groups, which is sort of related to my work around advocacy for particular bills under construction, but also media accounts, Twitter accounts, and how sort of larger communities of people use language to interact with policies and changes related to those policies.
Well, thanks, Rachel. It's a really good example to answer my question. And I wonder how do you connect the micro level analysis or observation of the communication, interaction, or interpretation with the more macro level of structural issues in relation to policymaking and implementation? So any one of you would like to say a little bit more about that?
So I'll get us started on it. So I think first off, it's helpful to just recognize that not all scholars are necessarily aiming to do that. Some scholars, so we have a chapter in our text that focuses on membership categorization analysis. And while you could certainly identify implicitly some of the potential implications for broader structural concerns analytically, this scholar, Justin Paulson, he focuses more particularly on the micro, with that being the methodological assumption and intent of the approach that he takes up. So I think first it's just helpful to always keep in mind that not everyone is aiming to do everything with an individual study. And sometimes it's really helpful for us to have a collection of studies that really attends to the micro, or a collection of studies that really attends to the macro. And then sometimes some people traverse thinking across micro, macro, and some would even argue for there being a meso. Kate Anderson has done some policy work where she illustrates this micro, meso, macro kind of perspective. And so I think first off, it's just helpful to keep that in mind. Nonetheless, quite often people are interested in macro concerns because of their desire to see, and also assumptions related to what counts as outcomes and impacting practice. So as an example, a couple of our authors do attend to more micro concerns related to specific policies. And also argue for some more macro implications. So we have a chapter Hilary Lustig developed that attends to the disciplinary policies within schools. And this particular chapter is one that also can speak to some more macro concerns. And she does that both methodologically as well as in her discussion, attending to the ways in which these policies both produce particular identities at the micro level, but also have implications for who's included and excluded in the schooling space and what this might mean for actually rethinking how these policies are both developed and then implemented within the context of the school itself. And so that's just one example within our text that attends to both moving from here are the micro implications that we can see substantiated in the data set, and what might this mean at a macro level, and then also then what might be some of the implications for this work.
Well, thank you, Jessica. Do you have anything to add, Chad and Rachel?
Well, one of the things that I think is important to understand is that many of the policy studies that have been conducted or have been recently published have used primarily the interview approach to actually reporting their findings or deriving understandings of the policy process. And one of the innovative things about language-based methods is that we can actually begin tapping into other sources of information that have not necessarily been utilized as fully or as focally in policy research. So, for example, we know that there is currently a strong proclivity among some U.S. policymakers to use Twitter as a way of influencing public debate. We actually have not historically looked at Twitter as being a potentially valuable source of discourse in most policy research. And yet one of the chapters in the edited volume and also in the special issue uses Twitter to learn about and look at how identities are constructed through Twitter analyses or through Twitter statements. That has some really interesting and novel applications in policy research, because not only does it allow us to begin looking at how in very short snippets of text, policy discourse and policy ideas can be influenced, but it also shows to a certain extent how various policy actors, particularly when they have a policy agenda that isn't necessarily as valued or isn't as respected by the current policy elite, it allows us to be able to see how those policy positions and dispositions are being vilified to a certain extent in the literature. And so, for example, we're able to see a great deal of how individual populations are being targeted through these discourses and how various policy issues are being made relevant or irrelevant to populations where they historically have been. And so it really creates some really interesting opportunities and potential for research in the field. The other thing that it does is it opens up some interesting mergers between existing fields and now potentially policy implementation research. And so, for example, you can bring together not only analyses of statutory regulations, with those public policy debates. And you can actually see to a certain extent how the policy debate has influenced or informed those statutory definitions or discourses. And so it just really pushes us to think differently about what data can be used. It pushes us to think differently about how certain populations and audiences are being presented or represented. And most importantly, it really opens up opportunities for us to unpack and really mine more deeply how some of the policies that are being introduced are actually coming to exist in the public's consciousness or in their understanding of what the most important policy issues really are.
Well, yeah, that really speaks very well about what you said previously about the contributions and how these perspectives make contribution to this field. So what are the targeted audience of the book? So are policymakers part of the audience, or mainly the book is targeted to academics, for example?
No, the primary audience for the book is both policy researchers, graduate students, and then also policy practitioners, so policymakers. But we don't necessarily situate the book as an applied manual by any stretch. We really aim this book at a scholarly audience and are encouraging scholars who use language-based methods to take up policy issues in their research.
And then also the flip, we're also encouraging in the text those that perhaps are unfamiliar with language-based methodologies however engaged in educational policy work for this particular text to act to sort of be an invitation for them to explore further and potentially think about studying how these particular methodologies might inform and even push their work forward. So in many ways, we're offering the text as both a volume for those that are familiar with these perspectives, as well as those that are unfamiliar, as a way for people to enter a new space.
I think that's kind of a nice way of thinking about your earlier question about connecting macro and micro. And although it is important to point out that that isn't everybody's goal, I think a lot of there are a lot of cases where people who study policy become interested in language-based methodologies because at the end of a more traditional policy analysis, the questions that they're left with can really only be answered by a more meso or micro level approach. And so that often is the invitation in itself. It sort of is a way of addressing the unanswered questions in studies that that focus on interviews or network analysis or a case study or even more of a traditional evaluation of a given policy and its outcomes. So sometimes the connection between macro and micro is really the way that the study design is framed around a question. A macro level question really needs a micro level answer.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And also I have a different question, which is about your collaboration. I'm just so impressed by how seamlessly you work with each other in producing this book. So I wonder if you could say a little bit more about this collaboration, like how did you divide the job and how did you select the exemplary studies in this book?
I can speak to that a little bit, and then Rachel and Chad, you can chime in as well. So first I'll address the issue of how did we select the empirical studies that were included. And as I previously noted, this book really grew out of a two-part special issue that grew out of that earlier conversation at the International Congress of Qualitative Inquiry. And so for this particular volume, we initially did a first layer invitation to the authors that had contributed to the special issues. And those that were interested were invited to contribute an additional study and or a methodological conceptualization. We had a couple other invitations that were made based on us knowing of scholars that were doing some really interesting language-based methodology work, but had initially not been at the stage of being ready to put them out in a journal. So we have two chapters from Hilary Lustig and one chapter from Hilary Lustig and one from Justin Paulson that those individuals were not part of the special issues, but they were known to us in other contexts of doing some interesting and innovative work with methodologies as well as policy, and they were invited as well. So that was our process of conceptualizing that. And so very much our early work with our special issue, which involved extensive peer reviews, was part of that decision as well. We also had a peer review process for the edited volume as well. So that was part of the thinking related to that. And as far as how we conceptualize the work process, I think if you just kind of return back to what we shared in regards to our areas that we bring to this work, much of our work was divvied up, so to speak, in connection to where we play in our day-to-day work. So I play in the methodological area mostly, and my colleagues play, so to speak, in other areas. And so we brought those different perspectives to this project, and that really shaped how we went about conceptualizing the feedback that we provided authors and conceptualized how we wrote up the introductory chapter, as well as the concluding chapter. So essentially we take up chunks of the text as we contribute our own areas of expertise to the volume. We basically could conceive of it as a patchwork design, so to speak, where we contributed in various patches to the different thinking. But We also conceived of it as an equitable project. So we can't really tell you who took up what task and who took up, I don't actually even remember who took up what task. It was one where we just had a plan and we all contributed to moving it forward.
Wow. Yeah. That sounds amazing. It's amazing to see how your work complement each other's work and how you just work collaboratively and collectively toward this product, toward this production of the book. And well, we have taken so much time from you today. And before we wrap up this podcast, and I have one last question, which is also like we usually traditionally ask our guests. The question is, what have you been working on recently? So would you like to each talk a little bit about your current work?
Sure. So I can talk first. This is Jessica. So most recently, I've been engaging in some methodological work related to applied conversation analysis. So an applied perspective to conversation analysis, so the analysis of conversations and its application to institutional settings, be it educational settings or mental health settings. So this particular work has been in the form of a different book, a pedagogical book. That's been my most recent project, and my energies have really been centered around that. But related more specifically to this volume, Chad and I are also working right now on a piece specifically related to the study of governance talk in state board education meetings, and we're applying conversation analysis perspectives to understanding that data. So that's my most recent work.
And so we've also, as a parallel to this, we also have a paper that we're working on that focuses on the use of language-based methods within the interactions and exchanges between leadership coaches and school administrators. And so we're looking at video data that was collected over a 6-year period that focuses, that includes leadership coaches who are working with school administrators in a university-based programmatic setting. And we're looking at how issues of school reform and school improvement are introduced into those coaching conversations so that we understand how that is both a reflection or a reification of the broader accountability environment. And then I'm also working on a project right now that focuses on the implementation of new equity standards related to the Title I Act as part of the Every Student Succeeds Act. And I'm looking at that from a more traditional policy perspective within which I've used an interview study design.
And what about you, Rachel?
My current work is focused on transcripts, court transcripts from court cases where teacher evaluation decisions were being contested and brought to court. So I've been looking at the way that expert witnesses use language to construct different versions of their own expertise, and also how their expert talk works up different versions of reliability and validity for different statistical tools that are used in teacher evaluation. I also have pursued the line of inquiry that led to the chapter that's included in this book, and I've been thinking about how other kinds of genres of talk and text inform the way that testimony is written. So I've looked at how conversion narratives are really similar to the testimony that people write about legislation in general, and I've explored how that's worked in particular with the bill that chapter is about here in Connecticut. And in the future, I'm thinking about expanding that not only to conversations about bills, but conversations within and between professional groups and advocacy groups in things like position statements and standards for professionals and just information publicly available information on websites that work in different ways to construct versions of needs around reading and definitions of the act of reading and of reading difficulty.
Wow, cool. So you should really let us know once you have new works published And we look forward to have you again in our podcast interview. So thank you so much for taking your time to join us today and to talk about such a wonderful book. Jessica, Chad, and Rachel, it's a really great pleasure to talk with all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Pempe.
Well, thank you. Bye-bye.